Welcome to the Sensory Project Show with Rachel and Jessica. We're here to share all things sensory, occupational therapy, parenting, self-care, and overall health and wellness from a therapist's perspective, providing raw, honest, fun ideas and strategies for parents and families to implement into daily life. Thank you so much for joining us. We also have just recently launched our new therapeutic ebook bundle. So those are all of the resources from the club in 2019 and 2020, the first year that we did the club. And there's so much information in there for you guys.
But it's all organized so you don't get overwhelmed.
Yep. So lots of the visuals and the handouts and things that we talk about in our podcast episodes we have in there. So you guys can check that out with the show notes, the link in our show notes.
Yep. Everything is linked. It's all there. So you can get it.
Hey guys, welcome to episode 122 today of the Sensory Project Show.
We are Rachel and Jessica, and if you are a new listener, welcome. If you've been here for a long time, we're excited to have you back because today we are talking to Amira, who is an occupational therapist who specializes in early intervention.
Yeah. And so we actually met her through Instagram, of course, because y'all know that's where we live. And we wanted to chat with her about her experience with the NICU. She is very passionate about the NICU, and she did her research in school in this area, as well as the implications with feeding and sensory development. And you guys know that those things are right up our alley. So we are chatting with her today.
All right, we'll just jump right in.
All right. Hi, Amira. How are you today?
Good. How are you guys?
We're good.
So good.
We're really excited to talk with you. But before we jump into all of the really important things that we want to talk about, we have five secret questions that we're going to ask you.
Ready.
Would you rather hold a hot light bulb in your hand for 5 minutes or sit in a freezer for 5 minutes?
Sit in the freezer.
Oh! You don't want to hold a hot light bulb? I love it.
I think that's probably what I would choose too.
Yeah, I might. Right now especially.
What is your favorite way to de-stress?
Take a nap.
Oh.
Or go outside.
Yes.
Are you a good napper?
I'm an excellent napper. I've always been.
That's a good quality to have.
How long do you nap for?
It just depends on how stressed I am. Sometimes I just need like a 20-minute nap. And sometimes it's not even me falling asleep. I just need to like lay down and decompress, turn my brain off for a little bit. But it could also be 2 hours. Who knows?
I don't even remember the last time I napped.
I've napped a lot these past months.
Yeah, that's fair.
You have a good reason.
Yeah. What does your morning routine look like?
I walk my dog. I have a little Yorkie named Coco, and she's a princess. So I have to walk her in the mornings, and then I do like my skincare routine. I love anything related to skincare. I have a glass of orange juice every single morning. I have to have a cup of orange juice and some kind of small breakfast.
No coffee?
No, I'm not a coffee drinker or a tea drinker, but like orange is my coffee. I have to have it every morning.
Orange juice. That's a new one. Yep. We have not heard that one yet.
Do you add a little bit of champagne in there?
Only if I'm really stressed.
And then you take a nap.
Exactly. Yes. You get me.
Oh, I love it.
Okay. Do you prefer pancakes or waffles?
Waffles.
Why?
They just taste different to me, but I like them with the topping. Like, they have to have something on top, like fresh strawberries are really good. I don't really like whipped cream, and I have to have maple syrup. That's the one syrup that I love.
Okay. We were laughing. We were like, they're the same thing. I'm like, no, they're different.
they're very different.
I know, it's so weird.
All right, our last question and our favorite one. What is your sensory quirk?
Ooh, I have so many, but I'm going to go with, I crave proprioceptive input, so I sleep with a weighted blanket, but I also have to sleep with a pillow on top of my head.
What?
So it has to be, don't have something on top of my head and it needs to be like one of my heavier pillows, and I just create this little opening so I can breathe through it, and I will sleep like a baby. But okay. If I'm anywhere and I don't have a pillow to sleep with on top of my head, I have so much trouble falling asleep.
Oh my gosh.
Do you need like a weighted eye mask or something?
I know.
I'll make you one. I'll send one to you so you can try it.
Perfect.
All right. Awesome. Well, let's get started. Tell us who you are, what you do, why you do it, how you do it, all the things.
Yeah. So my name is Amira. I am a Southern girl at heart. I was born and raised in North Carolina, but I've lived in a lot of major cities from OT school. So I went to OT school in Boston, Massachusetts. I did my clinicals in Houston, Texas. I did research in Seattle, Washington.
Wow.
And I'm currently living and practicing in Arizona. So I have been all over. I absolutely love to travel both domestically and internationally. I actually attended the World Federation of OT conference in Cape Town, South Africa a couple of years ago. So I love it, and I can't wait until, you know, things are back to normal and we can travel again, because I miss it.
Yeah. Wow. That's so cool.
Yeah. And so what I do is I'm a pediatric occupational therapist, and I work in early intervention. So I work exclusively with the birth to three population. And most of my kiddos have a variety of diseases, diagnoses, conditions that are impacting some area of development. So that could be physical development, gross motor skills, fine motor skills, cognitive skills, communication, social emotional, and of course sensory processing is a huge part of what I do. But fun fact, I'm also, and I haven't even talked about this before, but I'm actually a certified newborn care specialist. I'm curious if you guys know what that is.
Say it again.
A certified newborn care specialist.
Oh, no. What does that mean?
Okay, Rachel, you might be interested in this. So,
yeah, fill me in.
So I used to do this right before I did it throughout OT school, and then I did it right before I started like my real OT job while I was studying for boards. And what it is I would go to the homes of families exclusively night shifts. So it would be anywhere from about 8 hours to 10 hours, sometimes even 12 hour shifts at night, with families who had just given birth, and they would come home and they would need some assistance. And so I would be there throughout the night with mom, and I would kind of like bring baby to her.
Sign me up.
Nursing or bottle feeding, a lot of support in such important occupations. So rest, helping baby get on a good sleep schedule, helping mom sleep throughout the night so that she's more refreshed and able to be during the day and not so tired. Dad usually would go off to work, and so dad wouldn't have to worry about getting up throughout the night. So it was a super fun position. It's not widely heard of, but there's like a very small community. Like, if you're ever interested in it, I always tell pregnant mamas, like, go look into it. It's so good. Like, you're going to feel so refreshed in the morning. And it's just nice to have someone who, like, can, you know, talk you through anything that you might be feeling. So there's a lot of maternal mental health that happens when you're a newborn care specialist. So it's really cool. So that's another part of who I am.
That's awesome.
That is so interesting. I've never heard of that.
Which is sad, because new moms need those resources.
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah, it's great. And I think I first heard of it because I was nannying, which kind of brings me into why did I decide to become a nanny. I've always just had a love and a passion for children, specifically infants and toddlers. I'm a big sister myself. So I have a little brother and a little sister who actually are not so little anymore, but
right.
They're always my little brother and little sister. So I've always loved being around kids. So I did a ton of just nannying throughout undergrad, high school even. And so one of the families I used to nanny for had twins, and I would come in every morning. She was so refreshed and so vibrant. And I was like, did you sleep last night? Like, how are you so just happy and excited and ready to take on the day? And she's like, oh, we have a newborn care specialist who comes at night. And, you know, she takes care of the twins for me. And so it's just really easy because she just had to feed the boys and then, and, you know, give them back, get them a care specialist, we'll put them back down to bed and everything. And so that's when I first heard of it. And I was like, that is so cool. And of course, it was the population I love. So that's kind of how I got into it.
Wow.
So did you have to get certified to be able to do that?
Yeah, so it's a certification program, and I got certified in Boston. And you basically learn everything related to infant development, milestones, how to support moms. You do a lot of understanding lactation. So not as in depth as being a lactation consultant, but you have to know like different positioning for bottle feeding, breastfeeding, that kind of thing. So it's pretty cool.
That is cool.
I love that.
Thanks for sharing that with us.
Yeah, of course. So back to kind of why I became an OT. I initially was on the path to become a pediatrician again because I love working with kids and I knew that is what I wanted to do. I also always had an interest in just the medical field in general, learning about the body, how it works was always so cool to me. So I thought I wanted to be a pediatrician. And then from there, I wanted to specialize and become a neonatologist because I started getting more interest in the NICU, prematurity. I had a couple family members who were born premature. And so just understanding like, oh, they develop a little bit differently. I'm kind of curious, you know, how neonatal therapy works and things like that. Actually, not neonatal therapy yet. Sorry, neonatology, how neonatology works. So I was initially on that path. And then for a variety of reasons, I decided medical school was not for me. So I had like this whole life crisis in the middle of undergrad. And I was like, oh my gosh, like, what am I going to do now? So I was actually nannying for an OT at the time. She's a hand therapist. And so I was like, hey, tell me more about what you do. What is your job? Like, what does that look like? I know it's in the medical field and you seem really happy with it. So she told me all about OT and she told me that I could do pediatrics, of course, and that you could also specialize in doing neonatal therapy. So I was like, oh my gosh, I'm sold. This is exactly
perfect. Best of both worlds.
So that's kind of how, that's how I got into OT and learning about all of the different things that you could do as an OT. I love the fact that even within pediatrics, there's still so much you can do, but then if you happen to want to have a change and you want to do something else, you can go out of pediatrics. And so there's just so much that you can do with it.
Yeah.
And that's how I got into it.
That's one of our favorite things about
exactly,
it.
Yeah. So you said you work exclusively with birth to three. Mm-hmm. Do you work in a NICU?
No. So I work in the early intervention settings, which is in the home. But the reason I got into the EI space really is because my doctoral research in OT was all about NICU, sensory development, impacts on feeding, and that kind of thing. So I started to learn a lot about what that experience is like for families in the NICU. And then I also just learned more about the impacts or the effects of NICU on development in different developmental areas. And so I spent a lot of time in NICU, and neonatal therapy is still fascinating to me, and the neonatal therapists have such a heart for what they do, and I absolutely love that. But I will say that I found being in the NICU, therapy didn't always quite take precedence because the goal is for the babies to go home. And so a lot of times we have to work around the medical things that are happening, which I completely understand. But I was just kind of curious, like, okay, what happens after they leave the NICU? Like, I'm reading about all of these impacts on development and things like that. And so I really wanted to work with those families in a more long-term capacity and to really see those effects and try to help what those effects were that I was seeing. So that's how I got into the EI space, because being in the NICUs, I always heard during discharge, okay, we're going to refer you to early intervention. That's really good. And so I was like, oh, okay, maybe that's more in line with what I want to do if I want to have these long-term connections with these families and I want to learn more about what the impact of the NICU is over time. So that's actually how I got into the EI space, is because of all the research that I did on the NICU and effects on the sensory system and things like that.
That makes sense. I can see that for sure. I just did a continuing education course on like OT's role in the NICU, and it's so medical, and it's like just OTs are just so much like they're on the back burner. It's not the priority, but the things that they can help with and the things that they can do in the NICU, it's huge. It's amazing. And it's all about quality of life, which is obviously very important.
Yes.
For these little babies. In school, you focused on NICU and sensory development. So I know that we have a lot of listeners who have had kids who've been in the NICU. And let's talk a little bit about that connection and just your knowledge in that area.
Yeah, so there is a lot to talking about the NICU and the effects. And so I kind of want to start off with talking just about the environment. Because if you haven't been in the NICU before, you might not know all of the different elements that can be considered harmful to an infant's growth and development. But I do just want to point out that they need the NICU environment, of course, to survive, to thrive, and to eventually go home. So by no means am I saying the NICU is bad with what I'm about to say, but I'm just saying that there are some elements of the environment it. So there's like exposure to bright lights, for example. And so when they have this exposure to bright lights, that's going to throw off their circadian rhythm, and they're not going to know when the sleep and wake cycle should be happening. And we know that in order for them to really get better and to leave the NICU and just for development in general, rest is so important because that's when everything is developing, when they're resting. So if you just think about like that small thing, you know, the exposure to the bright lights, that's going to throw off their cycle, and they're going to have problems sleeping sometimes. The other thing that's super interesting is the sound in the NICU. So there's actually really high sound levels that to our ear, it doesn't seem really loud, but to a baby who is already very sensitive to any kind of sensory stimuli, really, it's very noisy in there. And so the last time I checked, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommended a maximum noise level of about 45. And the studies have shown that those noise levels in the NICU rarely drop below 60, and a lot of times they're exceeding 70. That's so to wild. Just kind of put that into perspective, about 30 decibels is going to be a soft whisper, 40 decibels is going to be a refrigerator hum, 60 decibels is about a normal conversation, and then 70 is the sound of a washing machine or a dishwasher. So if you just think about a 70 is what they're saying that NICUs often exceed, and it's just the sound of a dishwasher or a washing machine, that's honestly not super loud again to us, but for babies who already are at much lower threshold for sensory input, that is pretty noisy when those levels should really be staying at about a refrigerator hum. So that was just something super interesting that I learned in my research, and things that you don't even really know until you know you start to look into it. The other thing is just the exposure to all of the handling that has to happen in the NICU. And some of that is positive handling, right? So parents come in and do skin-to-skin care, and they have, like, cuddlers who come in. But they also often undergo these really painful procedures. And for a long time, you know, research showed that, well, maybe they don't feel the pain. But that's not the case at all. You know, they are feeling that pain, and they're developing these touch aversions and things like that. And so from my own experience and EI, they work a lot now with families from the NICU, and it's been so interesting just to see that impact and development. But I had one kiddo, he was maybe a year and a half when I started working with him, and he had spent the first 12 months of his life in the NICU, never left the hospital or anything like that. So you can imagine how much sensory input his little body was having to receive throughout those 12 months and what that impact on development might have looked like. And the thing that I saw biggest was that touch aversion. So because he had been handled so much, he had essentially formed a negative association to all kinds of touch, even if it was a positive touch. So I would try and, like, you know, just touch his hands very gently, and he would just pull them away, scream and cry. And it was so sad. And so we worked a lot on desensitizing him. He didn't want to pick up any toys because he didn't like his palms touched, and he didn't like touching other things. And so, you know, just reading about what a touch aversion is in the NICU and then actually seeing it in practice as an early intervention therapist was just, it kind of confirmed why I love being an EI and why I get to see that and then work on it. And happy to report, he is now about 2.5 and he is picking up all of it.
Yay!
Gestures, and I'm like, yay!
Well, then
working on sensory play, messy play next. But
I was going to say, what specific interventions did you use with him to help with that?
So a lot of desensitization techniques, so like brushing, doing a lot of deep pressure. So we started off with deep pressure, not super light touch with him, because we found that's the one that was the most overstimulating to him, and it caused him to be the most dysregulated. So we started off with really deep pressure. I encouraged mom to do palm massages throughout the day, specifically around my daily routine. So that's another part of EI, is we want to always implement these things around a daily routine. So, you know, if you're changing his diaper, let's do a palm massage. If he's going through a feeding, because he's going to feed you too, let's do a palm massage and that kind of thing, just to get him used to having that touch. When he starts to show interval of his toys, we let him play. And then I had mom add different sensory textures to them. So like Velcro dots and a couple of his, like the little toy with the phone, and he liked to press the buttons. So I said, okay, we're going to add a little Velcro dots on it. Or he had a rattle, and so we wrapped a pipe cleaner around it so that he had to touch something fuzzy. So it was a lot of just modifying the toys that he was already interested in, and then having him touch a couple of other different textures.
I so good.
That. I think the beauty of OT is like, oh, they already like this toy. Well, let's modify it.
They used to joke and say, oh, here comes in here. I'm just going to make your toy worse now. Oh. I'm actually making it better, of course, yeah. But it was kind of a joke that we had.
I love it.
That's perfect.
So good.
Well, and then I always think about the challenges for those NICU babies when it comes to the vestibular and proprioceptive systems, because they're just laying in this little tiny bed and they're not getting movement, they're not getting compression, and how that affects them.
Exactly, yeah. And so I have a couple kiddos now who really have trouble with vestibular input. And it's interesting because it can go either way. So they can either be intense vestibular seekers or they can be very sensitive to vestibular input. And so I've definitely seen, you know, both of those. And, you know, the sensory system is so fluid, as I'm sure you guys know. And so things are constantly going up and down. And 1 week they can be a seeker, the next month they can be an avoider and that kind of thing. But I kind of wanted to talk a little bit too about just like why kiddos are so impacted by these different harmful elements in the environment. And as I'm sure you guys know, even if there is a typically developing infant, they still have a much lower threshold for sensory input. And that's why I get frustrated so quickly. And that sensory system just continues to develop, you know, as they get older. So even with a typical baby, they're going to have trouble filtering through some of that sensory input and that kind of thing. But if you think about the kiddos who are in the NICU, and I'm talking specifically ones who were born premature, but of course there's other kiddos in the NICU who might have like heart problems or something like that. But specifically kiddos who are born premature, they lack what's called neurobehavioral organization. And this is like a huge topic that I looked into when I was doing my research to see why exactly these effects are so prevalent and why they're so, you know, long lasting for some of the kiddos. And essentially what neurobehavioral organization is infants have to take in the sensory input, so whether it's auditory, tactile, vestibular, whatever it is, and they have to organize it within themselves and have an appropriate response to that. But because they lack it, they often are not able to organize it, and so they're not able to have an appropriate response to that stimulation. And if we just think about like, well, why does that matter, you know? But as OTs, we know that they have to be organized and regulated to participate in occupations that are super important, again, to a typically developing baby, but definitely to a baby in the NICU or who was born premature. So occupations like eating, rest, social participation with their caregiver. If they're not in a super organized state, that's going to make participation and can be much harder. So it's a really interesting like concept to really understand like, why does it matter and why is it affecting their system so much? And it's really because they lack that neurobehavioral organization because their brains are sensitive, they're still developing, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that is a good point because we see it a lot with the kids that we work with in the clinic who are typically a little bit older. Mm-hmm. We don't have a lot of super young kiddos right now, but we always call it organization of behavior. And so we'll report on that and they're trying to figure out that appropriate adaptive response, because if they don't have it, there's no way they can participate. And so sometimes we'll spend the whole session working on finding that adaptive response and making sure that they're having it. And so the activities that we do, they facilitate that. And I think that's important to know, not only as a therapist, but also for parents to realize as well, like you have to observe your child and figure out, are they even like responding to the environment, responding to the sensory world in the most appropriate way possible? Well, if they're not, then how can we ask them to participate in things like school, you know?
Exactly, yeah. And that kind of goes back to my work in early intervention. So much of what I do is addressing those sensory challenges.
Let's talk a little bit about the NICU and its relationship to feeding.
Yes. Okay. So it's funny. My doctoral research topic changed 3 times while I was in OT school. So the first topic was all about what we just talked about. So really looking at the NICU environment and the impacts, both short-term and then the long-term implications. I didn't really talk too much about that, but there are some long-term implications, a couple studies that have looked at kiddos across the board who have been in the NICU and then have been in like the school-aged population, and they're seeing difficulties with self-regulation, attention, memory, that kind of thing. So that was really my first topic. That morphed into my second topic, which was all about the impact of the NICU on feeding, and specifically the impact that feeding has in relation to being discharged home with an NG tube, so the nasogastric tube. So kiddos in the NICU, a lot of times they are in there because they need to gain weight and, you know, they're working on feeding and things like that. But early discharge becomes possible if they can just go home with an NG tube. And so most families, by that point, they're ready to leave. They're like, okay, you know, we'll just do this NG tube, get them to eat more, gain weight, but we don't have to actually be in that environment. However, being on the NG tube is good because then they can leave the NICU, but they're not getting the same exposure to just the oral motor skills that they need or the oral stimulation that they need from either breastfeeding or bottle feeding. So it starts to impact their feeding later on. And then from that topic, I actually worked with the pediatric intensive feeding program at Seattle Children's Hospital. And we looked at kiddos who were unable to transition from the NG tube because for whatever reason, they were unable to take anything by mouth. So they actually had to do the G tube. And so that program worked exclusively with kiddos who had been fed through a G tube for basically their whole lives. They had never gotten off of the tube. And so the sensory impacts that I saw just from being discharged from the NICU with the NG tube and then switching to the G tube were so great. Great in that it was very profound, not like great. But it was just so evident. And, you know, these kiddos had difficulties with everything surrounding feeding because eating is such a sensory-rich experience. You know, you have to, like, touch the textures. You have to smell it. You need your interoception, which those kids actually had a ton of trouble with because they didn't have hunger cues because when they're on a feeding schedule, they typically don't allow them to get hungry. So they never even knew what hunger felt like. And so when they're in this program, part of it was decreasing the amount that they were getting fed by the tube to increase their hunger cues. And so, you know, you're working on, okay, we have to just deal with explaining to them what hunger is and that you can eat when you're hungry. But then you're also having to deal with a lack of oral motor skills because they didn't have that practice. You have to deal with a lot of texture sensitivity. So because, again, they weren't doing much feeding and eating by mouth, they were not getting the same exposure to different textures of food. So it was really interesting, but it's cool how when it started, what my project initially started out with really showed me like a trajectory of the impacts of being in the NICU, not only on sensory development, but then on feeding when they go home with these feeding tubes. So there's a lot there. And then the other part of that was, especially with kiddos who are in the NICU, part of the feeding difficulties they have is because they practice like upper extremity restriction in the NICU, which sounds really bad, but it's not. They have to do it because they don't want the babies to pull out, you know, the necessary lines and tubes and things like that. But that really inhibits that natural like hand-to-mouth exploration that we want to see, not only for like tactile reasons, but also just to get that oral motor exploration. And so they don't have a lot of that, so then they go, they're not really bringing things to their mouths. And so that's also an area we work on in early intervention with these kiddos who didn't have a lot of that hand-to-mouth exploration. We're just going to teach them how to pick up a toy and like mouth it if they're, you know, 2-3 months old and they're supposed to be doing stuff like that. So it's very interesting stuff.
There's so many different components and so many added challenges.
Absolutely, yes.
But also it's stuff that you wouldn't necessarily think about. You know, as a new mom, you've just gone through this traumatic birth. I'm assuming it's going to be a traumatic birth. It's your child is premature. They're in the NICU. You're like, I'm not anticipating this in your maternal journey. And then all of a sudden you have all of these curveballs thrown your way. And the last thing that you're thinking about is your child's future ability to eat. And
or play anything.
Or develop. You're not thinking about their sensory system. But I think it's so important for that piece of education to be shared with families. And even neurotypical kiddos who were born, you know, at an appropriate gestational age, you know, we need to be getting in their mouths and we need to be tapping them and massaging them and just touching them. And that's something that I'm very passionate about, is just like almost preventing these future sensory challenges from occurring. And so I think that's really important to be able to educate families who, whether they are going through this journey now or they have a child who's been at the NICU and they've graduated and now they're working on development. So I'm so glad that you brought that up.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will say, I think that professionals in the NICU, whether it's therapists, nurses, neonatologists, they're all really becoming more aware of the long-term implications of having a NICU stay. And so I feel like they are being a lot more mindful of just more developmentally supportive care. There's actually like a whole model centered around developmentally supportive care in the NICU now. And most it came from like the nursing journal, but it can be applied to the therapists working with kiddos too. There's also a couple of research articles, and I don't really have time to go into all of that right now because I could literally spend all day talking about this topic, but there's a couple of research articles that are now specifically looking at what sensory strategies can OTs implement. Well, OTs, PTs, and speech therapists, or any kind of neonatal therapists, what can they specifically implement in the NICU to kind of mitigate some of these long-term effects that they're seeing? And so it's super interesting. They give suggestions for different auditory things, visual, vestibular, tactile, and so they're looking at that right now and really trying to figure out, well, what is also the ideal frequency and duration to provide these sensory strategies. So
would you be interested in sharing some of your favorite research articles and studies with us so we can link them in the show notes?
Yes, I was going to ask, can I do that?
That would
yes.
be wonderful.
Yeah, let's sidestep. We're going to talk a little bit about the racial disparities in the NICU / OT / healthcare. I know it's a topic that's heavy on everyone's heart right now, but you're a woman of color, and I feel like if anyone can like present this in a graceful, eloquent way, you can.
Thank you. Yes. Okay. So let's start with racial disparities in the NICU, because that is a huge part of why I am so passionate about this population and working with these families. So the stat that really kind of jarred me a very long time ago in doing research about what the NICU was and prematurity and birth rates and things like that is that in the United States, the preterm birth rate is among Black women is 49% higher than the rate among all other women. And that number has held consistent for a very long time. That number has not changed. So as a Black woman myself, to know that I am at a 49% higher chance of having a preterm birth as a Black woman, when and if that day comes, it's shocking to me. It's disappointing. It's frustrating. It's hurtful, you know, that this disparity exists. And so it's something that has really fueled my passion in wanting to work more with these families. So there was actually a position paper put out by the National Association of Neonatal Nurses about 2 or 3 months ago, back in June, and it talked about racial disparity in the NICU. And I think that this was a great paper. It highlighted so many great stats. And so I'll be sure to include this for you guys to also include in the show notes, because I think that this is really important for people to read. But I did want to just go over a couple of the studies that they talked about. And so they did like a ton of different studies to kind of summarize everything that's happening in the NICU as far as the racial disparities. So what they're finding is that there's an increased risk for preterm birth, specifically amongst Black and Brown communities. And that is because there is a lack of access to prenatal care a lot of the times for these families. And so they're not getting the proper care they need. They're often a lot more stressed. They're having to work up until, you know, their due date. And so that's bringing even more stress upon them. And so basically just these poor social determinants of health that, you know, I know we've talked about in OT school and things like that, that just because of, you know, where you live, you have a different access to quality of care. And a lot of times in these communities, it's a much lower quality of care. So infants from minority groups are a lot of times born in these institutions where there is a lower quality of care because they're underfunded. They don't have all of the resources. The nurse to patient ratio is sometimes really high. And so they're having, you know, missed cares and not so much emphasis on like breastfeeding because they just don't have the time to spend with these families. So that's also, you know, part of the racial disparities in the NICU is just the lower quality of care. And it's just so sad to know that where you're born can literally impact your mortality rate. You know, there's studies now that are saying Black infants are at a much higher rate of dying even than other infants. So it's really sad. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of awareness that needs to be raised about this. And there's a lot of things that need to change on the systems level and healthcare in general. And so, you know, that's a whole other conversation in and of itself. But I also wanted to just go over some of the stats that this position paper did put out, because I think it's important just, you know, for us to talk about and be aware of. So like I said, the statistics are showing that Black infants have a death rate more than twice that of white or Hispanic infants. And there's also a higher rate of significant morbidities in the Black and Hispanic groups. Compared with white infants, black infants are more likely to be delivered in hospitals with a higher risk adjusted for mortality rates, of course, lower quality scores in those NICUs. So there's just, there's a lot that needs to happen. There's a lot that needs to change. And like I said, it's really on that systems level.
It is, absolutely.
Was that study just in the U.S. alone?
It was, yes.
Wow. Mm-hmm. It's amazing, the way that, you know, you're born. And it's similar to the NICU. I mean, we're not even talking about NICU babies right now. We're talking about just babies being born. And they're already fighting to survive, you know? I just feel like that's awful.
Exactly, yeah.
I'm glad we're talking about it.
Yes, of course. Yeah, no, I think the conversation needs to be had more because, like I said, you can't fix a problem if you don't know the problem exists. And so this is something that, like I said, I was not even aware of until I started looking into things. You know, there's no commercials on TV talking about racial stereotypes. And thank you. So, like, how else are you going to learn about it? But I know for me, so once I kind of found this out, that there was these racial disparities in the NICU, and understanding the importance of NICU families being enrolled in early intervention programs, it kind of prompted me to start digging a little bit more into underrepresentation in my specific setting and like what I'm seeing. And so when I first started out in early intervention, I realized that the caseload was not reflective of the demographics of the area I was in. There were absolutely no Black children on my caseload. And I thought that was really interesting because if we're saying that Black infants are going to be the higher group in the preterm birth rate, and they're going to need EI services, then why are they so underrepresented in EI services? And so that kind of prompted me to do a lot of digging and understanding where are the gaps, you know, like what are the perceptions of Black and Brown mothers with child development in general, but then also seeking help from other people. And, you know, is that a factor into why, or, you know, can we do more outreach in these communities? And so I think, you know, I can't speak to all of the racial disparities across all the settings, but I think that it's really important that if people truly want to see change, look into your specific setting, whether that's outpatient pediatrics or acute care or inpatient rehab. Is your caseload reflective of the demographics of the area that you're in? And if not, why? And I think that is a huge call to action for us as OT practitioners, because we're all advocates, right? And we want to elevate awareness about, you know, certain topics. And so really doing your part, specifically in your setting, I think that's a great place to start. Like, now I feel like I know a lot about early intervention disparities, and like now I can go out and tackle that. And so I think that's really important for just us as OTs to be mindful of.
Absolutely.
Were you able to figure out where all the Black kids are on your caseload? Like, why aren't they getting the help that they need?
There's so many different reasons. There's lack of follow-up to the early intervention program in general across the board. And then the accessibility to early intervention services. So a lot of families in those communities, they have to work, and they're working from like 8 to 5. So when are they going to have time to have someone come into the household? So it's not super accessible for them. It's also just a lack of knowledge and awareness. So during the discharge process, again, going back to where these infants being born in the NICU, if it's lower quality of care, they're not getting as much time even spent on all of the discharge process and like all of the referrals and follow-ups that they need to go through with. So they're being, you know, bombarded with all of this information, but they're also having to contend with other factors inherent to this community. So, you know, poverty and increased stress and that kind of thing, lack of support systems. So if you just give someone a piece of paper and they're already stressed about, you know, going home and having the support they need, they're likely not going to follow up with an EI program referral. So there's definitely a lot of reasons. Primary care was also one of the areas that I looked into. Like, you know, families are not being told about early intervention services and primary care provider appointments. And so there's like a lack of referral there. So it's really just awareness. And I think that there's so much more outreach needed in these communities to reach these families. Mm-hmm.
Totally. So then what did you find was your next step for you personally to make it better?
So that is something I was working on until COVID happened.
Oh,
and I don't want to get too much away because I'm still really working on it. But the first steps are really figuring out, like you said, where are these families, right? Where in the community can I reach them best to be the face of EI and let them know, you know, this is a great program. We're working with you. We're not there to look down on you or to judge you. It's also really just important to understand the perspectives and the feelings that a lot of Black and brown families have towards healthcare people in general, right? It's never been the super warm and fuzzy feeling that our communities have when they go to like doctor's appointments and things like that. So, you know, you're contending, like I said, with so many different factors, but I think the first step is doing that outreach, getting out into the community, spreading the word about what is early intervention and that kind of thing. But COVID happened and I wasn't able to do as much as I wanted in the community, but that's kind of my next step, is really trying to reach these families in different ways.
Okay.
Wonderful.
We'll start kind of wrapping it up just a little bit, but what would you say is the biggest challenge with what you do right now?
So with what I do as an early intervention provider, and as a, I'm going to say new-ish grad, because now I've graduated a little over a year ago, so I feel like I can add the ish to that.
Yes.
So as a new-ish grad, I'm often on my own, of course, in early intervention, and I have to do so much problem solving in the moment and on the spot, and that's especially tricky for me because it's not always topics I'm familiar with. So for example, I had a question about like night terrors one time, and I was like, I have no idea. But you know, I think, and that was challenging because I don't like to not know the answer, but I've learned that as an OT, there's many times when you're not going to know the answer. You know, it's a journey of like lifelong learning, and that's okay. But starting out, I hate it when I didn't know the answer to something. And so that was a huge challenge for me. But I think that, you know, if I flip it and look positively, what am I getting out of something that's challenging like that? It's really encouraging me to stay up to date on research and interventions, and I'm constantly having to learn something new. So although it is a huge challenge for what I do, I think that it's making me become a better clinician and practitioner.
I love that so much.
We can relate with that a lot. You know, anytime parents want to ask us questions, we're like, I don't know, but we're going to find the answer and we'll get back to you. And then it's your job as a therapist to be able to go home and do that research and find out the answer about night terrors.
And then becoming just an overall better therapist along the way.
Absolutely.
I love it. That was a good one. That was good. All right, let's talk about just quickly what motivates you every day to get up and go see these kiddos. Obviously, you're making a difference in their lives, but what is it that really motivates you?
I think for me, it is progress and growth, and not only in my life as a clinician, but in the lives of the families and the kiddos that I'm working for, seeing them make progress, reach their milestones, grow and learn and play, that is all super motivating for me. And I think because when I see them progress and I see them grow, then that means that I am progressing and growing as a clinician, you know, as a pediatric OT. So I think that's just really motivating for me, is to know that being an OT is such a process of growing and learning. And I just feel like it has made me a better person professionally and personally in my life, just working in this setting and with these families who have had NICU stays. And like I said, seeing that impact on their development and being part of the solution to helping them, you know, achieve their milestones despite this rough go that they had when they were first born. So it's great. I love supporting the family, I love supporting the kids, and that's definitely my biggest motivation, is just being able to empower these parents with all the tools they need.
Wonderful. And yes, none of our listeners could see you right now, but even when you talk about that, you have this like big glowing smile on your face. Like you can just tell, you can feel the passion when you're talking about it. So just have to tell everybody that, since they can't see you.
Okay, so do you have anything new that you're working on professionally? Anything specific that you can tell us?
There are many exciting things going on, so stay tuned, but I can tell you that it's all about the areas that I'm passionate about. So it's all about reaching NICU families, supporting their journey from leaving the NICU to going home, just that transition. Of course, working in EI, all of my families, but specifically reaching families in minority communities, all of these things are impacting what type of collaborations I do, what kind of speaking I do, what kind of podcasts I'm doing. And so there's so much exciting things going on. So definitely stay tuned.
So speaking of that, where can people reach you so they can keep track of all that you're doing?
Yeah, so I am most active on my Instagram at marvelousmiracles with two R's .ot. And I also have a newly launched website, www.marvelousmiracles.com. So you guys can go over there and check that out. And that's, my Instagram is really a lot for therapists, somewhat for parents, but the website is really going to focus on supporting parents even more. So I'm really excited that that is up and running and awesome. That I can start to connect more with you guys.
Yay. Congratulations. That's exciting.
Thank you.
Good. We'll make sure we link those in the show notes.
Yep. Can you give our listeners one piece of advice before we go?
My biggest piece of advice, and I think that this is fueled by all that 2020 has been, all of the ups and downs, is that I would say leave your comfort zone. Do things that are scary. I recently heard this phrase, do it scared. And I've really been living by that because I am definitely more of an introverted and shy person. I don't like to put myself out there like that. And that's literally all I've been doing like this entire year. And so I've really left my comfort zone and it's opened up so many doors and opportunities for me to really, you know, change my life for the better, but to also change the lives of families and therapists. So I would say leave your comfort zone and do it scared would be my biggest piece of advice.
Yes. All right, my dear. Well, before we let you go, do you have any questions for us?
Can I ask, what is your biggest sensory quirk?
Oh, there's so many.
I hate when people ask this question.
Oh, gosh.
I always forget what mine is. I think it changes every time somebody asks.
Yeah, I have a lot. I'm definitely more sensitive to vestibular and auditory input, specifically like competing noises, like if the TV's too loud, if someone's talking to me, if there's a bird chirping outside, I'm like, I can't handle it. And I kind of lose my mind a little bit. And then I get motion sickness too, so some of the vestibular issues as well.
Yes.
I'm a big fidgeter. Like, I have to have something to fidget with, and I've also recently discovered that I have to chew something, so like I'm constantly chewing gum, or I like will start to grind my teeth. That's kind of recent, but definitely a big fidgeter.
Yes. Always.
That's so funny. I relate to both of us.
Yes. And it's so funny. I mean, part of our mission here is to just empower people to recognize your sensory system, and everyone has one, and it's unique, and it's okay to have these quirks.
Yeah, there's nothing bad about it.
But to know about them and to be able to, like, modulate your life and figure it out and be able to get a fidget to hold on to and to turn the volume down.
Exactly. To have a heavy pillow.
Exactly. Put the pillow on your head.
I am going to make you an eye mask and mail it to you so you can try it and see.
Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, my dear. Thank you so much for spending this time with us. We are so happy to have met you in like virtual life.
Yeah.
And we look forward to seeing all that you accomplish in your just very fresh career. You're awesome.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure being here with you guys.
Yes.
All right. We'll talk to you later.
All right. Bye.
Okay, guys. Hopefully you loved this episode. Hopefully you enjoyed listening to all of the wisdom that Amira shared. I like that she is still considered a new grad. You know, she's really just starting out in her career in occupational therapy, but she's already doing so much and she's so passionate. And I think she's going to just keep doing amazing things.
Yeah, she's really pushing herself out of her comfort zone to make a difference and advocate in this field. And honestly, that's what the occupational therapy field needs more of. So props to you, Amira, seriously, for rocking it. And we're so glad that you took time out of your schedule to chat with us. And we'll make sure that we link all of the research that you shared with us and anything else that we talked about in this episode will be linked in the show notes. And we just can't thank you guys enough for spending your time with us today.
Yes, and as always, if you can leave us a review on iTunes, that really helps us reach more people. And if you have ideas for someone that we should interview on the podcast, let us know.
All right, you guys, we'll chat with you next week.
Okay, bye.
We are so excited to work together to help create confident kids all over the world and work towards a happier, healthier life. Just a friendly reminder, this is general information related to occupational therapy, pediatrics, and sensory integration. We do not know you or your child. Therefore, we do not know any specific needs. Therefore, you should always refer back to your pediatrician and occupational therapist for more information.